Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon. This is part two of, I don't know how many I'll end up doing, on the new Church Handbook of Instructions directives regarding LGBT people and especially their children. I won't go ahead and frame that again. I'll refer you to part one of that as well as all the reading I'm sure that most people who are tuning in have done. I am thrilled to, though, have three friends and good thinkers here. With part one, where we had Carolyn Pearson and Mitch Main on, we had wonderful voices. We certainly did a little bit of broader 10,000-foot view level stuff, but it was a very, very personal podcast with where is it that they're finding faith and hope and strength and a way to, you know, stay motivated to go forward and things like that. What I've got here are three scholars, three people with doctorates, all educators. And we're going to take, you know, I definitely want their personal voice, and I'm sure the personal voice will come through. But we thought we'd do a bit more of a broad, you know, maybe 20,000-foot overview of, you know, what was bringing this on, and what do we predict for the future, and why do we think it happened the way that it did, and just all those sorts of things. So I'm thrilled to welcome back Brad Kramer. Brad, would you quickly reintroduce everybody to who you are and background and current interests?
My name is Brad. I received my PhD in sociocultural anthropology from the University of Michigan last year. I did religious anthropology and linguistic anthropology. I did my dissertation on sacred language, secrecy, and certain aspects of gender in Mormonism. For a while, I worked, I did publicity for Greg Coford Books. So I've, you know, been somewhat involved in the Mormon studies community and Mormon publishing. And more recently, I opened up a Mormon bookstore and art gallery in Provo. So I've been kind of curating Mormon art and working with my partner, Ryan Roos, curating rare Mormon books and documents and, you know, trying to use it as a space also to kind of sponsor and encourage public education and lectures and roundtable discussions, et cetera, especially with authors who are writing current and relevant work on Mormonism.
Yeah, so the store's called Writ and Vision, W-R-I-T and Vision. And
yep.
Congratulations, you guys really have been hosting lots of events and stuff, so way to make an impact.
Much appreciated, and I appreciate the invitation to participate here as well, Dan.
You bet, and I have to say it to everybody, Carolyn gave a nice quote at the end of part one, and she wasn't sure, you know, she'd picked it up somewhere from the internet, and she hadn't noted where it was, and it turns out it was from a blog post of Brad's, and it was the quote
just Facebook update.
Oh, yeah. A Facebook update, that's what it was, okay. Yeah, not a blog post. Yeah, and so I couldn't really link to it on the website. I'm actually meant to go in and at least make a note there, but it was the one about, as I'm looking around, I'm seeing LGBT people doing a lot of comforting of Mormons, and many people will say that, you know, the LGBT persons are not worthy of us, and Brad's comment was, from what I'm seeing, we're not worthy of you, and that was a beautiful comment, so thanks for that contribution, Brad, already.
Appreciate it.
I'm excited to have both Rob Box and Nancy Ross with us here. Let's actually have Nancy introduce herself first. The two of them are first-timers to Mormon Matters podcast, but they might be already quite familiar to many of you because they are the co-hosts and creators of the Faith Transitions podcast. So, Nancy, would you tell us a little bit about you and what you do and your background and kind of some of the, you know, whatever the theoretical, you know, interest you have that may come in today? And then perhaps just do a quick introduction of Faith Transitions podcast as well.
My name is Nancy Ross, and I'm an art history professor of all things at Dixie State University. And while I teach, and I've been teaching art history at Dixie State for like 9 years now, but I moonlight as a sociologist of religion. And my training is actually in medieval art history and representations of apocalypticism in 13th and 14th century England. But actually, most of my research now focuses on contemporary Mormonism, but I would say contemporary Mormon history, contemporary Mormon feminism, and kind of the sociology and history of those things. So that's kind of what I do now, specifically looking at things like women. You know, women is a big issue. Women and gender and intersectionality are important to me in my research. And yeah, so that's kind of a little bit of what I do and who I am. And I'm a fair bit out of my grad school now. I think Rob and Brad are a little newer.
A little closer to it. Well, it kind of dawns on me as, you know, like I majored in philosophy, you majored in art history. There's not that many jobs in that. So it's one of those majors like, oh, you know, yeah, but you actually scored a career out of it. So way to go.
That's right. No, I mean, art history is always the first degree people mention when they're listing useless degrees. So that's me. Yes, I have 2 degrees in art history.
Well, way to kick tail. Nice.
Yeah, no, but I, you know, I have found a way to make that work. Yeah, and Rob and I do the Faith Transitions podcast, which I really have to credit to Rob. It was his idea, and we've done close to, I think, 8 or 10 interviews now.
Yeah.
Not all of them are up yet, I think.
Not all of them are up yet.
No. Yeah. We'll be up to 12 or something in terms of what's recorded very soon.
Super. Yeah, and so this is Rob's idea, and he came to me and asked if I would co-host. And yeah, no, it's really great because we ask people about their faith stories, and you get to ask all these questions that you couldn't really ask someone in real life, you know, not very easily. So we get to get really nosy about, you know, like how people practice their faith and how that changes and how belief changes and how they feel about things. And that's been really fun. I didn't expect how much I would like interviewing people about their faith stories, but I really do.
Well, you guys do a great job. And
thank you.
Rob, fill in anything that she didn't do about the podcast and then give us your background and things.
Sure. I guess I'd say we're also branching out. New stories that are coming up will have faith transition stories that fall outside of the Mormon tradition.
Yes.
So we are big tent, to use the term that I'm sure we'll get thrown around a bit tonight, faith transition stories. So you can expect to hear some interesting stories coming up with folks in other traditions. And just a great opportunity, I think, for people to hear solidarity in terms of how people negotiate spirituality and faith and, you know, their day-to-day lives.
And, you know, when you get into that developmental stuff and when you start recognizing your own faith journey, it's so rewarding to just know that others from other traditions are basically going through the same stuff. And it just made me feel like I had so many more fellow spiritual travelers.
Right. Yeah. And we actually intentionally, well, when I registered the domain, I went with Faith Transitions, plural, because the way I conceptualize a journey is, as you just mentioned, as a developmental thing across the life course.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a static transition. It's not an endpoint. We're interested in stories as they're developing. And one of the things we really like, people get on and say, well, my story's messy. Do you want to hear that? And we frequently tell our guests, that's what we want. We want the mess. So,
nice.
Yeah.
Let's go dirt. Yeah.
Right.
In the mud. Wrestle in the mud of it all.
Right.
Cool. Well, great. Rob, tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah. So I am also an academic. My PhD is in sociology, so I'm sure Brad and I will have parallel, if not complementary, points throughout our discussion here. So my PhD was at Purdue, and I primarily do work in identity issues. So that's, in terms of tonight's discussion, that's the kind of hat I think I'm going to try and wear. I'm going to try and be analytical and objective in the sense that a lot of my published work is on identities and how identities are maintained and how language is a central part of that.
Nice. So, Very good. Well, guys, thank you so much for being on. It's just a pleasure to have you. And I'm just going to let me just start with the biggest questions that just, you know, let's call for some analysis here. What do you think were the biggest factors that were driving this? And is there something in any of those factors that, you know, helps explain the timing? Why did this come along now when it seemed like we were trending in different directions? So many people, I think, last Wednesday would have thought, oh, you know, we're getting there. You know, slowly but surely, stuff is moving in this direction, and then it seems reversed. Brad, do you want to try first with what do you think the biggest factors or factor is?
Sure. And for me, part of the lens that I interpret this through goes back to some research that I did in grad school on a lot of the official discourse that emerged during the Prop 8 campaign. So in particular, the kinds of things that church leaders in California, including apostles, were telling, you know, LDS church members and volunteers who were participating, you know, describing the stakes. And one of the things that kind of emerged for me was that there was this real concern that I think they only saw gay marriage in California as a kind of bellwether in this larger concern. And it was this concern that that the church's moral position on sexuality, on homosexuality, was going to become increasingly marginal, increasingly viewed as intolerant and bigoted. And it was increasingly going to push us out of the mainstream of the wider culture. And so...
So are they embracing that now, where they were concerned that they didn't want to be in the mainstream, or that they started being in the mainstream, and now they're choosing differently?
I think that their primary concern there was less the way that we're perceived on the outside, although, again, I think that they thought that would be a factor, but more this question of maintaining their moral authority within the community with younger generations. So it seemed to me like there was a real fear on the part of church leaders that 10, 20, 30 years from now, if they tried to essentially preach the same sort of moral line on the question of homosexuality, that at that point, young people in the church would kind of roll their eyes or respond to them in kind of in the same way they would as if they were preaching some kind of racist teachings or against interracial marriage or something like that. In other words, that they were really concerned that their uncompromised position on homosexuality would actually compromise their moral authority with young Mormons over time, and that the degree to which Mormonism embraces so much of the cultural mainstream would actually exacerbate that problem. So I think they're trying on the one hand to sort of stem the tide. I think they felt like what happens in California will sort of signal what's going to happen around the country, and that if they can keep the brakes on in California, that it'll happen more slowly, more incrementally, that there won't be this huge tide change. But also,
so
do you think
they saw success in Prop 8 in their minds?
Not in the long run, because I think Prop 8 was an instance of it sort of backfiring, that they won the battle but it didn't end up being a victory in the war, because I think it did end up creating problems that they didn't foresee in terms of the credibility that they have with some people, and especially younger people, on these kinds of questions. And I think there was another dynamic in Prop 8 that is actually going to and in the aftermath of Prop 8 that is actually going to factor heavily into the aftermath here, but we can get to that a little bit later.
Yeah.
So in general, I think that they are trying to preserve and uphold not just authority in a technical sense, but the moral authority that they have with a church that is changing rapidly and whose population, you know, whose membership is embedded in a wider community that is also rapidly changing, specifically on this question. Okay. I think they're very afraid that continuing to preach that gay relationships are sinful is going to undermine their moral authority, including and especially with young church members. And so if that's an underlying concern that a lot of leaders have, then it makes a lot of sense that in a context where gay marriage is now totally legal and becoming very normalized in the country, that they would have a concern that normalization could easily creep into Mormon contexts if married LGBT people and their families are extended a significant amount of fellowship. You know, I think that they're aware that contact with, regular interaction with contact with knowing, having somebody in your extended family, having somebody in your community who is gay, having gay families has a very strong destigmatizing effect. So it makes sense to me that they're nervous about that. They would see that as also something that potentially threatens their moral authority.
Okay. So if moral authority is the key, it sounds like you're thinking that in the back of their minds, they're willing to shrink the church. They're going to shrink it from these families, more and more will be excommunicated. And they know they would have to know that people who are sympathetic towards that are also going to go out, because the only way that moral authority can survive and or grow in this way that you're saying is it's going to be because the fringe left.
I think they were willing to accept a certain degree of attrition here, and I think they probably also dramatically underestimated the amount that it's actually going to cause. Right. So this is it's similar to Prop 8 in the sense that they underestimated the negative consequences for church membership, but it's also much bigger than Prop 8 in that sense, because the negative consequences, there's always a fringe of people. There's always a fringe of progressive Mormons that them doing something controversial, in the culture war is going to kind of piss off, and people are going to potentially resign in protest or whatever. But that's always a very, very tiny percentage of people. And I think that what happened with Prop 8 was that in California, outside of California, Prop 8 had that effect on that fringe, but inside California, Prop 8 harmed a lot more people and harmed a lot more people's confidence and their feeling of fellowship and their trust in the church and the church leaders, a lot more people than just the fringe, but it was still contained to California. Mm-hmm. And I think what they're realizing now is that it's affecting, again, a much wider percentage of the church than that tiny super progressive sort of activist fringe, and that it extends, obviously way beyond the boundaries of California. It's essentially North America and Western Europe, most of the English speaking world where the church is. I think they're going to see a much more significant attrition than they had any anticipation of.
So got a little bit of prediction there too. Rob or Nancy, any questions for Brad? Otherwise, we'll go to Nancy next for the same big question.
I would just say that I think it's possible, though, maybe just to challenge or just to presuppose another option that the church is wanting to harden a core in a sense. I think that there are, you look at Elder Oaks and others on the quorums, and these are thoughtful, intelligent people making, I think, deliberate decisions. So I think that there is a possibility that some of where this came from, like you, I think you suggested that back at Brad a little bit, Dan, with your follow up there. You were saying, well, is this maybe potentially the church coming in and reclaiming what it means to be this or that and redefining boundaries? I think that's possible. That's very, very possible. I don't know.
I agree, by the way.
I agree with that as well. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say, I don't know if that's mutually exclusive. I certainly think that what Brad's talking about there applies, but I would also be remiss not to interject that I think that there is some thoughtful boundary maintenance going on.
And I think that the two actually work really closely together, because I think that they are wanting to clarify a boundary. They're wanting to solidify a core, but they're wanting to do it around this notion that the high leadership of the church can be a confidently trusted moral authority on these kind of shifting, these issues that are shifting in the wider cultural environment.
Yeah. And I think that's a very valid one.
It's a valid that they're doing this.
Perspective on
valid perspective, but not necessarily going to be effective or something like that, right?
Well, I mean,
or will be effective because the boundaries are. Yeah,
I think it's going to be more effective in terms of the boundary maintenance that Rob is talking about than they think it will be. I think that the base of the church will actually shift right as this issue affects many more people than the church anticipates. Shall I then jump in?
Yeah, and Rob, come back to anything more on boundaries that you want to do.
Nancy,
go ahead with your
I agree with what Brad is saying, and I think that there are a lot of different ways to look at driving factors here, because there are a lot of driving factors, and that this is kind of complex in how this stuff came about. So one thing I want to talk about, which is maybe a little less obvious and direct. There's a book by an academic named Mark Chavez, who does a big study of churches that had and had not ordained women. And this is part of what I've studied. And he's talked about how churches create alliances with other churches, often based on particular keynote issues that signify positioning with regard to the politics of a church. And issues like women's issues are kind of proxies for this kind of larger political positioning. And I would also say then that LGBT issues are also could be proxies for a church's position on modernizing versus conservative tradition, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And so what I think we've been seeing in the larger kind of Christian landscape is that some of the church's traditional allies, and I'm thinking really here of Catholicism specifically, that Pope Francis has really been pushing boundaries of what might have, maybe previously would have expected previous popes to come out strongly, like the LDS Church, strongly against, everything that's modernizing. Whether it's women's issues or LGBT issues. But Francis has been, I think, pushing boundaries in terms of acceptance, not by changing doctrine, but maybe by changing attitudes and also upsetting many conservatives in his church. I think that this is problematic from an LDS perspective because it signals a potential shift for one of its traditional allies in terms of alignment. Like, in terms of like looking at, well, what are the conservative churches doing? And if one of those flagship conservative churches seems to be sending out mixed signals with regards to some of these issues, then I think that that actually causes a problem for the church. I'm not saying that the church isn't responding to Prop 8 and the legacy, but I think the church is also responding to larger issues with other churches. Mm. And so I think one thing that we have seen recently is that the church is really trying to realign itself with kind of extremely conservative Christianity. And I think that we've seen that, especially in the World Congress of Families, which is a recent event that church leaders, LDS church leaders have participated in. The World Congress of Families has been identified by the Southern Poverty Law Association as a hate group and was instrumental in writing anti-LGBT laws in Africa that are extreme, with extreme consequences like death penalty and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that the church then, in seeing some of its traditional allies, because what happens is that churches do band together on like political issues, like with Prop 8, or they band together and work together on various charity-related issues or humanitarian issues. And there are alliances of churches. And what's happened in the past is when a church repositions itself politically, those alliances are broken and reformed. And so I think that what the church has done here is that in seeing some of its traditional allies send out mixed signals, I think part of what it has done is it's tried to publicly emphasize, not even just to church members themselves, but to kind of the outside and to the rest of the Christian world, like, no, we are hardcore conservative Christians.
Right.
And I'm not saying that that's the only lens through which to view this, but I think that that kind of alliances of churches element, that kind of stuff that Mark Chavez talks about in his book, is an important element in this, because I think we often complain in Mormonism and progressive Mormonism that the church takes so many of its cues from evangelicals.
Right.
And that's true. You know, like that's, we do take a lot of cues from evangelicals. And, you know, if evangelicals start getting really upset about modesty culture, then we start getting really upset about, you know, modesty and purity and that sort of thing. And so I think that these interfaith alliances are at least part of the issue here. And even though World Congress of Families just happened, that was in the works for a really long time. And so I think that that's something to think about as well.
Right. Those are really interesting. I guess what dawned on me is you say they're trying to, hey, no, we're true conservatives. We're stuff on this. Yet at the same time, they seem to be doing the dance on religious freedom front. And, you know, that press conference a few months ago was all about, hey, go ahead and sponsor legislation, but just don't call it marriage or whatever.
Right.
But in return, we want to have religious freedom. So I'm wondering, is there a proximal cause here on that religious freedom? And this just happened to be the playground for this particular round of the fight.
Yes. I think that that's certainly possible, that this is the playground for that particular fight. You know, I mean, a year and a half ago, it was women's issues. So I think that there are these various issues which are kind of proxy issues for the larger issue of modernization. Or liberalism, even. And the church, in terms of its political alignment, I don't mean politics as in Republicans and Democrats, I just mean as in terms of like Christian politics and religious politics in America, that I think it sees itself, and in terms of maintaining its alliances, it feels obligated to toe that conservative line, whatever the modernization issue is. If that makes sense. And again, this isn't the only way to view this issue, but I think it is like, I think a lot of the issues we're going to be talking about are like internal issues. And I think that, but there are also external to the church issues here as well.
Yeah. And I actually want to weigh in a little bit on your connection, Dan, and that Greta Nancy's comments on the, I think you're referring to County Clerk Kim Davis. Is that what you're referring
to?
And
I mean, Elder Oaks had Elder Oaks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually,
but I'm talking about that press conference that they called, and it was like, "Oh, let's go to work and do things together, and you know, give us this, and we'll give you that."
Right. He actually pulled up when I was thinking about this. I had a long plane ride earlier this morning, and spent the afternoon going through notes to put together my thoughts for this discussion. And that's one of the things I pulled out. Elder Oaks, I can even quote him if you want. I brought up that quotation because I thought it would come up to tonight as we're talking. He says, on the big issues, this is Elder Oaks at that press conference, both sides should seek a balance, not a total victory. And then he goes on, he says, for example, religionists should not seek a veto over all non-discrimination laws that offend their religion. And the proponents of non-discrimination should not seek a veto over all assertions of religious freedom. So that seems quite, in my reading, a contrast from what just happened last week.
Well, I think that there are a couple ways to read that statement. And one way to read that statement is to say, okay, he's really calling for balance and somehow a moderation or a middle ground.
Right.
But actually, I don't think that that is what that actually said. That's what he said.
Use your Urim and Thummim and tell me what it says.
I would do that.
It's a seer stone.
Get that thing in that hat. Yeah.
And my feminist Urim and Thummim says that actually that what he's saying, and there's no middle ground
right,
on things like non-discrimination and what the law was. Is it like you can have non-discrimination as long as it doesn't infringe on my religious beliefs, which actually leaves a really murky ground.
Right.
Like, and so, I mean, yes, I'm very much for the non-discrimination, and that was a very good thing. But saying insofar as it doesn't challenge religious people's religious beliefs, well, I'm not sure we've had a clear, like, clarification of the legal boundaries of this particular law.
Right.
And that we do, that the law often does give very big sway to people's religious beliefs. And that that's, so I'm not sure that that statement was saying what it seems to be saying. Because
so
in one
it.
Sense, he's saying, you know, balance and moderation.
Right.
But I'm not sure that that's actually a call for balance or moderation.
What happened? When did you get so cynical, Nancy?
Well, I've always been pretty cynical. I'm also very optimistic. So those two things really work against each other.
They cancel each other out, wouldn't they?
They do. It's just that I think, but isn't Elder Oaks a lawyer? So he would.
He is. He is.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know. My dad was a lawyer when I was a kid, so I'm some of this.
Yeah, he was Supreme Court judge in Utah, so.
Exactly. So yeah. I think he knows exactly what people, that people could take what he said in a variety of ways.
I see. Well, you're going to say something, Brad.
And that the legal limits of that law would tend to favor religious belief rather than non-discrimination.
Right.
I still think that Rob's larger point, though, is worth noting, which is that church leaders seem, for the last decade, and including and especially in the last few months, to be balancing two impulses, which is an impulse toward staking out their identity as conservative, especially on issues relating to gender and family.
Mm-hmm.
But also within that community, if you will, staking out a moderate place. So it's not just Elder Oaks' comments about balancing, mm-hmm. you know, non-discrimination, yeah. but it's Elder
right.
Oaks saying that Kim Davis is wrong. It's
yeah.
Elder Oaks,
right.
it's the actual explicit backing of the non-discrimination
right.
legislation in the first place. And it's
right.
Elder Oaks basically saying that the culture war is over.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not, and there are different ways you could look at this. You could look at this as trying consciously to strike a balance, or you could look at this as kind of different factions within the leadership. Very clearly, in the past decade, the
mm-hmm.
church is interested in two things simultaneously. It's interested in making Mormons look more normal and more mainstream.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
It's interested in making that, in staking out a position as standing up for traditional norms around gender and family, and in fact trying to make those two things work together by trying to keep traditional attitudes and traditional ideas about gender and family
mm-hmm.
within the mainstream,
mm-hmm.
within the cultural mainstream itself.
Right.
So they're trying to do these two things at once. So you could see that as something that, you know, somebody like, say, Elder Oaks is sort of consciously trying to balance, or you could say, you've got the mission department and church public relations and the I'm a Mormon campaign on the one side, and then you've got forces within the church hierarchy that are trying to publicly display an uncompromised stance and trying to make us distinctive and not normal, you know, not mainstream in our sort of commitment to traditional values, and so those things could be in dynamic tension with each other within the leadership, or it could be something that some leaders, like I'm thinking probably Elder Oaks, are actually consciously sort of trying to balance.
Right. And I think, yeah. And often I hear the argument that these aging men are out of touch, which strikes at me a little bit ageist in some sense, because I think maybe that's an easy escape from holding them accountable, because I do think, and we're picking on Elder Oaks a little bit here, but I think he's very thoughtful in his language choices.
Mm-hmm.
And is expressing an explicit, like you said, Brad, rejection of the legality of what was happening. So I think it was pretty thoughtful on that front.
I think Eldorado wants us to look like moderate conservatives.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that was a good point.
And not like the Westboro Baptist Church.
Right.
And even Elder Ballard's comments at the World Congress of Families last week sounded moderate within that framework. Sounded like it was they were trying to be a moderating force rather than a conservative radicalizing force.
Right. Good. Yes. So how does that fit with the pivot on Thursday?
Well, and see, the thing is, the explanations,
we'll have to get into that language then.
Yeah, it was like, no, we were just clarifying, this is what we've always felt was important. Right. So I think that really runs counter. So in their mind, this is not new. At least that was the idea that was attempted, that was expressed.
And I think I tend to believe that. Again, I kind of reject the notion that they're completely out of touch with the world and what's going on. I'm not comfortable buying that. Yes, maybe, okay, you want to make an argument that aging senior members of the quorum, for instance, President Monson, is his dementia. I'm sure those things cause challenges. But given the largeness of that body of 15 and some of the youth now, in terms relative youth of those who are part of it, the quorum, I think it's too easy an escape to just say they don't know what they're doing. If that makes sense.
I think that they're actually very aware of what they're doing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that they fully comprehend the bigness, the full effects. Like, they didn't anticipate, I mean, this is a different issue, lowering the age for sister missionaries and the tremendous impact that was going to have, and they've acknowledged that. But rather, maybe they thought it was more kind of token or nominal, the change that would happen. And I think that maybe what is going to happen here, or what is happening here, is that they think that this will, and I think Dan used the phrase, kind of trim the left fringe a little bit.
Right.
But I think that this cuts into more of that middle ground. This issue cuts into more of the middle ground of Mormonism, and not just kind of the fringe left. And that maybe is something that was not anticipated. That's my
guess. That's where the sort of the overplaying of the hand. I think that what they thought they were doing was balancing sort of progressive and conservative priorities, right? A sort of a progressive priority of reducing the tension that young children in the church feel if their families are nonconforming or whatever, and sort of protecting those families, even if it means kind of protecting them from church discourse or whatever, and balancing that with standing firm. And I just think they had no idea how sort of heartless and cruel this would look, not just to the fringe left, but that it would look at a minimum sort of very, very vexing and very befuddling and very and be heartbreaking to a much wider swath of the mainstream than they had any anticipation for.
For sure. Right. And before, Dan, you want to move on from this?
Well,
bigger...
I want to give you your chance to.
Okay.
I don't know how much of your original turn to go, and
you all gobbled it up.
I mean, as far as I know, some of it we've kind of got hints of, but give your pitch about what do you think was the overriding factors.
In terms of overriding factors, well, I'd like to build off a couple of things that we've just been talking about in our discussion. I pause because I'm thinking in my brain, are they really that out of touch? Were they really trying to go for a moderate centrist place to find, like Brad was expressing, a way to keep a balance? And that when he was having that dialogue, it reminded me of there's a very famous research paper on why people remain in strict churches. Actually, literally the title, I think, is Why Strict Churches Are Strong. Mm-hmm. Lawrence R. Yannicone, maybe, I think, if that's right. He essentially says that that there's this balancing act that must go on between the social world, the social environment that a church is forced to navigate or is necessarily navigating, and their ability to maintain a certain distance or tension between itself as an institution and the greater society with which they're embedded. And there is, it's again, in thinking back at that paper, the language almost word for word is that there's this kind of quote-unquote optimal gap where a church is walking a very fine line, trying to adjust where they're positioned in terms of expectations and boundaries in relation to the social changes that are going on in the greater environment. And in that paper, they actually talk about women's roles in the church specifically. And to bring it back to one of Nancy's comments, she said that last year it was women's issues. I think we could even bring in some of the dialogue about the doubter in the church over the last three, four, or five years.
Yes.
And in particular, if you want to just pull out a specific example, sort of the patron saint of Big Tent, we're moving in a positive direction, was Elder Uchtdorf. And a lot of that came out of his, you know, his talk, Come Join With Us, was that the title, in October of 2013?
Yeah.
Yeah, and his in that talk, I just remember many important discussions with friends and family about this shifting acceptance, this renegotiating, this nuance of boundaries. What seemed to me being expressed in those sentiments was, bring your perspectives, come join with us, right? Come join with us. He said that over and over and over. And then compare that to his talk, and I think it was in priesthood session this October, so just recently, where he's saying things like, doubt is Satan deceiving folks, that belief is available to some people and not to others, and he's talking about that there's no magic to belief, and on and on and on about the idea. And just that narrative changing, I think, also represents some of what the church was, I think, in my opinion, what they were trying to do in this policy revision was deal with some of the ambiguity that had happened in the dialogue. And like Nancy said, it can be seen in the dialogue about women's roles. It can be seen in the dialogue of how they've dealt with the doubter. And now we're seeing that dialogue shift where they're reclaiming what they consider boundary maintenance or identity maintenance with respect to LGBT issues. Mm-hmm. And I think that's maybe I'm setting up a straw man here a little bit, but I think you can see that with the higher levels of leadership leaving a lot of the LGBT issues to be dealt with at the ecclesiastical level or the local leader level, and you find that you get the roulette that we often talk about on the Bloggernacle. We find really great progressive stories where people are getting callings, where people are being accepted, and you get the other, of course. You get the stories where people are being rejected. And that was going on. And I think the brethren just said, okay, it's time for us to say what is and
automatic,
is not acceptable.
Yeah.
Right,
automatic,
yeah, there's no more question. This is the line.
Yeah.
So,
no,
again,
those are all good thoughts. Do you think that there was sociologists in their head, or is it just a felt need to draw these boundaries and to do the optimal tension with society?
That's a great question. I don't know. everyone is sort of an armchair sociologist.
Right.
We always joke because as social creatures, we all think, of course, I know what that discipline's
and
about.
It really only has to be one apostle who's read that kind of stuff to throw it into the mix, you know. So,
well, and I think that's true. I think to assume that they have no awareness of the actual empirical research that talks about these balances, again, what to me is a discrediting that I just don't buy. I just can't get it. I can't get my mind around that level of ineptitude. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so for me, just in a nutshell, if I were to just succinctly say, and I've had a couple conversations with close friends who are in a really bad place with this, that the language is pretty deliberate. It's not just marriage. It doesn't seem to me just a political act, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't just redefine marriage. They've talked about cohabitation, sexual cohabitation. They've talked about role relationships with parent, child. And that to me seems to go a little deeper than just some of these legal arguments that I'm hearing pop up.
Well, and I think if the policy change had just been that gay marriage required a court, I don't think that we would have seen the response or anything like the controversy. I mean, it would have been upsetting, but it wouldn't have exploded the internet quite like it has.
Right.
And I think would have been a more anticipated element as opposed to the children, which I really feel like has come out of seemingly nowhere.
Right. And Elder Christofferson explicitly says, that we don't want the child to have to deal with issues that are going to arise. I think that's kind of what he says. Nothing is lost to them in the end, I think is the language he used.
Yeah.
That they'll have the opportunity when they're adults, the age of majority, right? When they get to be 18, they can make decisions about their own personal lifestyles. But then that takes me back down to the core. Okay, so what kinds of assumptions do these expectations have of children?
Mm-hmm.
Do the assumptions of the origins of LGBT lifestyles come into this? Are they thinking nature? Are they thinking nurture?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And most of the rhetoric I've at least heard from the brother, and it's all tends to be social arguments for the prevalence of homosexuality and et cetera. So if that's the case, how can they set up a policy that explicitly socializes a child in a gay, transgendered environment, what have you, and then expect for a child at 18 to then, after that socialization process, reject the very thing that they have been, mm-hmm. Raised to accept as an option for somebody's lifestyle. So does that make sense? So
totally. Yeah, and the children piece is just so terrible.
That it's so terrible.
We could spend our entire time on it. And I wonder if that is one that they're going to back off on to some degree. I mean, Elder Christofferson did it, but, especially the shared custody situations.
I think that's what they're actually going to back off on.
Okay. I think they have to because
the shared custody situation.
Yeah. Carolyn Pearson mentioned, these children were created in part because of the church's policy to go ahead and get married anyway.
Yes.
And I just think that, it could be at a certain point. Well, if you adopt as a gay couple or if you use artificial insemination or whatever, way surrogacy or whatever it is to have a child, that may be what they'll do. It's still terrible. Even just labeling it apostasy, Nance, is terrible.
Right.
We ought to talk about that a little bit. I think there's some tentacles there that will help our discussion a little bit. But
I also want to kind of jump in here and say that in this issue over the children, hasn't Pope Francis just in the last few days reiterated that there is no denial of baptism for Catholic children with gay parents? So even though we have all this internal conflict, there's still external conflict as well with other conservative churches. And that's not, I think that's not to be underestimated, because that can end up severing long-lasting partnerships with churches on other issues.
So Elder Christofferson, correct me if I'm wrong, he said that the policy change was at least somewhat, or I don't remember his exact language, but it was a reaction to Supreme Court decisions legalizing same-sex marriage.
Right.
So do you think, I'm just tapping into your sort of broader cultural lens that you're bringing in with the reflection on the Catholic Church and changing culture for them. Do you think he's being honest when he says it's a reaction to the Supreme Court, or...
That seems
out of touch then.
I don't think he said reaction. I just think he said in light of it has happened. I think they have to say they were preparing for the Supreme Court thing to go that way. This has probably been in the works longer than that. I doubt it started after.
Yeah, I would assume too.
I doubt it started after. I'm sure it was in the works before. Like, I'm sure that when the church announced its participation with the World Congress of Families, which was months and months and months ago.
Right.
I mean, these sorts of things are set up most of a year in advance. And I'm sure that by then, that whenever that happened, they probably had some idea that about the time of the conference, there would be a new handbook with policy changes. So I'm sure that this really does predate by quite a bit the Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, I just pulled up his quote. He says, "The faith acknowledges the law, but not as a right that exists in the church." That is the clarification.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Okay.
Good stuff. Can I drive for a second?
Yes.
Let's take this into some.
Sorry, three podcasters.
I do want to talk about
here.
The apostasy. Yeah, that's right. So I want to talk about the apostasy piece, but I also want to just bring up some stuff from James Ord's comments to Gina. And I want to hear what you guys think, because this is, again, the timing issue and all that stuff more than what I think apostasy will bring up. And that is lawsuits Some say, you know, this is line drawing and firming up so that when the time comes that the churches seem to be challenged, that you must perform gay marriages, etc., we're positioning ourselves better. I thought the more interesting one that James Ord brought up on Gina's A Thoughtful Faith podcast was there have been some lawsuits already about parental alienation.
Right.
Meaning your church teaches things that have alienated my child from me. And it seemed to him that if there hasn't been anything on LGBT already, that the church is anticipating that coming down the road. And therefore by, you know, saying how clear this is the Mormon teaching, and we're doing these steps to not have children be exposed. We are trying to protect children of these people by not having them. In some ways, they were doing some preventative or prophylactic, you know, steps for those possibilities. How much credit? I mean, I think there's certainly some of that. I'm going to give it decent credit, but how big a factor do you think this would be versus the other things that you guys have brought up? And go to anybody. Brad, we haven't heard from you in a minute.
The attorneys that I'm talking to about these potential kind of liability cases, don't seem to think like it really has legs.
Well, I think most say they'll never be able to force a church to marry. Right. But
even issues like alienation, I just think that the statutory protections and even the constitutional protections that exist for churches, at least in the United States and in a lot of other parts of at least a lot of other parts of the world where gay rights and gay marriage are really gaining traction, are just not likely to budge much. I mean, I just don't think that we're in a legal or a political context right now or anywhere near either of those contexts where even very conservative churches have much, if anything, to fear in terms of even just civil liability. Okay.
I think that the legal argument is often one that's used and people accept it quite readily.
Yes, so it's that's like, a good right. point. It's a good
and
scare
so it's
thing.
Saying, oh, well, there are legal issues. You know, I mean, just saying that generally gets people to back off. So I think that there's a certain amount of like legal fear mongering that goes with saying, oh, well, for legal issues, the church had to do this.
That's fair, but I just, is that harm is okay as long as the law requires harm?
Well, No.
I'm just pushing back just because I find that morally deplorable if that's the source of it.
Well, you're using the word harm, and I guess that kind of takes us to perhaps the Benjamin Knoll article.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Where the Huffington Post article that was that today?
Let me call it up, and it's either today or yesterday.
Yeah, it was good. It was pretty well written.
Explaining reactions, and it was posted
today. And so one thing that I noticed when I read that article is that he used some of the work of sociologist Jonathan Haidt, who talks about moral foundation theory. And I'm just going to read a little bit from a few sentences from the article. Jonathan Haidt has argued that there are five key foundations of moral reasoning that structure how humans interpret what is right and wrong. And so these are different kind of binaries. So the first one is harm and care. The second is fairness cheating. The third is loyalty betrayal. The fourth is authority subversion. And the fifth is sanctity and degradation. And so he says that liberals are particularly attuned to the kind of harm, care, and fairness cheating, while conservatives are more strongly attuned to loyalty betrayal, authority subversion, and sanctity degradation. And so I think that there is a sense here which, you know, like as liberals, we absolutely immediately pick up on this kind of issue of harm. We gravitate to that because this idea of harm and care or fairness and cheating are some of the most important kind of moral values that liberals might have, where they're not the most important values that conservatives might have, which they're going to value loyalty and authority and sanctity probably over care and fairness.
Mm, right.
And so this idea of harm then doesn't necessarily enter into their moral reasoning.
Mm.
or right. at least it's farther down the list. And
right.
Right. And one of the things about this model is there's a defense for every single one of these right. and leaning this way or that way. It's to me, it's like Liahona, Iron Rod. It's kind of neutral, but it's still quite descriptive.
It is. And I've used this stuff before, and I think it is a good way to describe the differences between conservatives and liberals, especially in the church, and our priorities.
And the stuff on loyalty and stuff like that, I think generationally, wouldn't you guys all say people in their 60s to 80s are going to be a far more just naturally have an affinity for that just because of the way they were raised, perhaps, than today's free-for-all sort of, everybody gets to talk kind of culture?
Sure.
Yeah, I think there's a cohort effect. I would say that's probably one of those antecedent variables that's explaining some of this.
Loyalty versus betrayal. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, Nance, I appreciate you bringing that up. And did that step on you? Who brought up harm? Was that you?
Yeah.
That was you, Rob.
It was me. No. It's okay. Fine. And I think yes. And I have my own academic sort of professional reservations about hate, but I won't get into that here.
but about these five dichotomies, you think?
I think they're useful in as far as Nancy, like she described, they're useful in as far as they help articulate an issue. I think that there are other ways to frame some of these core values. Shalom Schwartz does a lot of work out of University of Jerusalem, if I remember correctly, that I think is a little more less ideological in origin. So I find it a little more useful. But anyway, that's kind of an aside. I think her general point is fine. I just, to continue with sort of my initial point on the issue when I was thinking about harm is the language here that they use, and I'm thinking about the policy language particularly, uses words like sexual cohabitation, which isn't traditionally a legal term, right? It's in the way that marriage is, let me say it that way. So while I do agree that there are political undertones, I think the language here runs deeper, and it runs deeper for me in a way that the language others or creates an othering or maybe even a special stereotype category that while probably is couched in maybe some of these legal motivations has, if that's not the explicit purpose, it implicitly creates categories of other folks who are going to be considered as other with these now ascribed labels, like I said, maybe even stigmatization, that will probably run deeper, longer term in terms of cultural transference than I think maybe just this moment of legality will.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So yeah, full stop.
Good stuff. All right. Well, let me get off the lawsuits one and move into apostasy unless somebody else wants to jump in with something before we do that.
No, I think apostasy is a good direction.
Okay.
Yeah.
The reason I want to talk about the apostasy thing, and like I say, the children thing, we could spend hours and bemoan and stuff, and I'm still holding out for a change, even though I still wouldn't like, anything. To last, but the move from it being a sexual sin, and basically they were trying to say before everything's the law of chastity, it applies to straight people as well. You just don't have sex, before marriage and all that stuff. They've changed it now to where it is now an apostasy thing, and this to me in some ways goes back to Brad, where you talked about their authority and their moral authority, but this seems to me to be a firm line being drawn about this is our teaching, and you as adults have chosen to go against our teaching, and we told you so, a little bit. So there's a little bit of a reassertion of their authority in this, but it's also the authority of teachings. And then I want you guys to cascade down. Is it fear that gender, the eternal gender of spirits and all of that other stuff, they're trying to make sure that, we still end up with that. God doesn't make mistakes. He doesn't put people, from ones, who are female spirits in male bodies and vice versa. Yeah, I'm just trying to. It's almost to me. I sort of sense a fear of doctrine crumbling, and then of course that has all the implications for eternal progression and eternal families and, you know, spirit babies and all that kind of stuff, or spirit bodies. So, what do you guys think about this move to make it apostasy? Have I analyzed it in a fair way, or do you want to push it back?
I don't want to answer. I'll let some others, because I talked most recently. So let me actually, what I want to do is read it. Is that okay? Is that
sure.
fair?
Mm-hmm.
That way we can all hear the language. Because I do think, again, I'm just going to stick to my guns. I think they're thoughtful in the way they
okay.
you know,
nice.
word things, and the language that they use, whether or not, and I completely agree with Brad's larger point that sometimes where they think they're going to punt the ball down the field isn't where it ends up. So, but let me read it so you can see what they had in mind. So under apostasy, it's at the very bottom of this change. It says, as used here, apostasy refers to members who, one, repeatedly act in clear, open, and deliberate public opposition to the church or its leaders.
That's where I was picking up that part. Yes.
Right, right. Two, persist in teaching as church doctrine information that is not church doctrine after they have been corrected by their bishop or a higher authority. Three, continue to follow the teachings of apostate sects, such as those that advocate plural marriage, after being corrected by their bishop or a higher authority. Four, are in a same-gender marriage. Five, formally join another church and advocate its teachings. So that's...
But one and two yeah. are absolutely kind of in the ballpark of what I was speculating.
Right.
The others don't.
I mean, for me, what's interesting here is there's a category in Mormonism, and it's a subcategory of the category of sin or transgression or immorality, and it's a category of apostasy. And apostasy is by definition the category of sin that is most intimately bound up with church authority.
Mm-hmm.
Some level, all acts of apostasy are explicit defiance, explicit rebellion against, an explicit kind of affront to or challenge to the authority of church leaders.
Good point.
Right.
So, so to call this apostasy on some level is to say that in some ways it makes sense, because increasingly church leaders were having to use authority not just as the primary but as kind of the singular basis for their teachings about not just homosexuality but about gay marriage in particular, right? This is more than anything else, this is about church authority,
right?
And so on some level what they're saying is that to be in a gay marriage is to be in a state of defiance of church authority, in a way that to be gay or to be an adulterer or to be a murderer or to be a rape, you know, these other things that are generally considered bad, or even things like word of wisdom, right, which are sort of violations of purity norms or whatever, but not necessarily open acts of defiance of church mm-hmm. authority. So it's connected to authority,
yes,
and
good.
It's connected to marriage. So the parallel to I think the parallel to plural marriage is important too,
mm-hmm.
because what you have in both cases is a situation where the relationship is not just not ideal, not just problematic, and not just sinful, but sinful in a way that can only be resolved through the dissolution of a family.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
So for example, if you have children that are the children of, you know, unmarried parents, right? And the parents not being married places them in a state of sin, but that isn't resolved by them having to break up. That can be resolved by them getting married. But in the case of polygamy, so again, I'm very conscious of all of the sort of the pushback on the too strong of parallels to polygamy, all the ways in which this is different from polygamy.
Right.
But I think in church leaders' minds, this is a parallel that is important, which is that polygamy and gay marriage are two family situations that are uniquely challenging, in that the only resolution that existing church doctrine can provide is the actual breaking up of the family.
Hmm.
Except we don't actually repudiate polygamy. We haven't distanced ourselves from DNC 132. And so, like, I mean, but I hear you. I would say that I'm not going to say doctrine, but I'm going to say that the practice of Mormonism is so tightly bound up with gendered hierarchies that LGBT or same-sex relationships challenge that kind of heteronormativity or that heterosexuality that church leaders see as being somehow essential in kind of a gendered order of things.
Mm-hmm. And yet gay relationships by themselves aren't apostasy. They're still on the list of, you know, may trigger church discipline. Whereas being in a marriage,
formal step, yeah,
right.
is on the list of,
or the formal step of moving in
must,
to each other, yeah,
must trigger discipline.
Yeah,
which is an interesting dichotomy because sexual cohabitation can impact a child, but yeah, I don't know that I had mentally made that sort of that linkage that you had just made there, Brad. The idea that in the apostasy category, when they take the time to actually define it, they do zero in on marriage. But when they're talking about social influence on child, they're broadening it out even to include things like sexual cohabitation.
They are.
Oh, I didn't notice that either.
And it's also important to note that cohabitation, you mentioned that that's a legal category, but it emerged in the legal lexicon in a relevant way as a polygamist legal category.
Right.
And then it became an ecclesiastically relevant category in Mormonism as Mormonism tried to distance itself from the practice of polygamy. And so cohabitation is in both legal terminology and Mormon ecclesiastical terminology is closely connected to polygamy. So again, I'm not saying that this is a rationalization, that it makes sense or that it's a justification. But I do think that the unique problems presented to church leadership, both in terms of marriage and family, but also in terms of challenges to church authority, I think that those problems that polygamous marriages present are the kind of default filter for how church leaders are now starting to think about same-sex marriage.
Yeah. And on their behalf, that's a very strong indictment because as Mormons, we like to rank order severity of things. And this then, if they're equating this as apostasy in terms of rank order of things that we can do that are distancing from God in terms of doctrinal or even the theological understanding in the Mormon tradition, it's the apostate who's at the top of that list, right? Quote-unquote son of perdition who is the most distant, unforgivable, unexcusable. It's the apostate to the extreme. So I think it's pretty telling, and I think I'm just maybe just emphasizing in a different way what you're saying, punctuating it a little bit, Brad, that they've labeled this very strongly, very carefully in this language and again I credit you for making that link for me, crediting the idea that they've piggybacked off of the language in particular with the polygamy to make that justification that this is, you know, a murderer would have a better chance at the end of the day of rebaptism or integration than the apostate potentially.
And remember that polygamy isn't fundamentally evil because it's not monogamy. In the Mormon,
right.
in this sort of
yeah, right.
structure, it's bad because to be in a polygamous, you know, for the cases that they care about, you know, most instances to be in a polygamous marriage is to have submitted yourself to an ecclesiastical and a putative sealing authority that explicitly sets itself up against the authority of the church and
right.
denies the authority
right.
of the church. So polygamy is in some sense the quintessential act of apostasy.
Challenge to
authority. And what they're doing is they're sort of piggybacking gay marriage now onto
right.
that
right.
as being a kind of fundamental affront to their authority in matters of marriage.
Interesting. Great stuff, guys. What about my other part about teachings are in danger about, you know, eternal families and structures and gendered spirits and anything like that? Do you think that's in a 10% factor, anything higher than that? Is, you know, because I love Taylor Petrie's article. I did a podcast on it where he's saying, you know, that isn't all that well established kind of stuff, that this is how babies are made in heaven, or spirit bodies are created in the afterlife. It's not necessarily through divine sex, and it's not necessarily that we have all that strong a teaching, at least in the origins of gendered spirits. And, you know, there's so much more he's arguing about families come together, and God's way of creating family is more through adoption than, you know, physical generation and things like that. Is any of that play in there, in this, you think, at all?
I don't think so, because that's not really how we think of families today in the church. You know, the family today is the nuclear family. The family today in Mormonism, you know, is generally, you know, two parents who are monogamous, who are biologically related to all their children. And I think that that's the ideal of family. And that even if the idea of gendered spirits wasn't important in the past, which I certainly acknowledge, it is certainly important in the present. And that comes kind of through the proclamation.
Right. So is this
which kind of negates what happened in the past to a certain extent, you know, and people aren't really aware of, you know, like on the ground on a Sunday in Mormonism, people aren't necessarily aware of like what the church taught in the past.
Oh, the history of the teaching. Okay. Right. Okay.
I mean, I think that it makes a certain kind of sense why we're so invested in this notion of the family. And I think actually you can literally reduce what Mormons mean as core to the family as gender complementarity, as this kind of fundamental difference between two gender categories. And that's a difference that's not just biological, but it's eternal, it's soteriological, it's, you know, backwardly and forwardly eternal. Because, you know, Mormonism, it has often been described as sort of blurring or dissolving certain critical binaries in the Christian cosmos, right? Distinctions between mind and body, between spirit and matter, between God and man, between heaven and earth, all these things are kind of blurred as Mormonism reaches its fullest expression, you know, Nauvoo Mormonism. But certain other binaries then kind of emerge, or certain other kinds of important tensions and stronger differences emerge. And they emerge for Mormons around the question of marriage, because the difference between Mormon marriage and Christian marriage or sectarian marriage or secular marriage in the 19th century couldn't have been starker.
Right.
So after polygamy, we start to lose that again. We start to lose that form of distinction. And so a distinction that has now come to matter a great deal to us, even as we've sort of, you know, overlaid a kind of monism onto the cosmos, one dualism that has emerged that has become increasingly potent over time in our consciousness is the dualism between male and female. So much so that, you know, by the mid 1990s, we basically canonized a sort of a bigendered cosmos, yeah. Right? And I think that, so, you know, it's interesting because Nancy said earlier that, you know, it sort of teeters back and forth between issues of you know, women's issues and LGBT issues. And I think that both are intimately linked in Mormonism around this question of wanting to preserve that binary, and that women's issues are seen as a threat to the binary in a similar way, even though or at least to a similar degree that, that gay marriage threatens the family as this sort of ultimate expression of cosmic, eternal gender complementarity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that certainly rounds us back out to some of the beginning comments that this is, in a sense, boundary maintenance, the Brethren reclaiming authority to define what those boundaries look like, mm-hmm. right, what it means to be in a role, man, woman, in the church.
Right. Hmm. Yeah. But, you know, the apostasy definition had opposition to church leaders, but also had about teachings and doctrine. And
right.
So I wanted to bring that up. And I agree that it's secondary, but I got to think that there's some stuff there.
Yeah.
I want to do two more things. I'm going to want to give you some closing thought time and stuff like that. But I just, we hinted at this, at least there might be some backing off on the children stuff. But can any of you see... You know, because we've talked about potential miscalculation, about the reactions that were going to be coming and things like this. Can any of you see some moves, or if you were prophet for a day or something, that could be the best possible scenario in terms of stepping back from what happened last Thursday? Does anyone, I'll just let whoever has either a positive idea or go ahead and say, I have no clue. Who wants to go first?
I mean, I could just say something quickly, which is that I'm not entirely sure what shape a graceful backing out would do. But I do think that probably Elder Oaks is in a position that if he really wanted to do it, he could find a way to do it. And it would obviously require, I mean, he's one who, although he in general is, you know, very lawyerly and speaks with a lot of confidence and speaks with a lot of authority. He is one who has actually, you know, been very comfortable letting some of his views shift over time and expressing those shifts. And he's one who, as recently as earlier this year, was willing to say, you know, he got asked about, you know, transgender and intersex persons and sort of how they fit into the existing, you know, Mormon cosmos. And he said, you know, we don't know. We don't understand that as well as we should. So in a weird way, maybe in a kind of Nixon in China way, it feels like Oaks might be in a position to, you know, gracefully kind of backpedal on some of this stuff, express a degree of humility that wouldn't come across as undermining the authority of the church or even of himself or of the institution. Maybe in particular if he kind of banded together with Uchtdorf. Now, do I think this is likely to happen? No, but I do think it's at least theoretically plausible that between the two of them, those two could probably probably find a way to engineer some progress here.
Yeah. Mm. Now, this brings me up something, because he was the one that says the church neither seeks apologies or ever gives them.
Yeah. Right.
But is there a certain moral authority or a boost? This would be the ideal scenario for me of just a straight out, we are sorry. We got this wrong. We know that children are, you know, everybody is welcome to God's kingdom. Our application of the standard to children was confused on our part, you know, or something, and we apologize. I mean, that'll be some short-term fallout for that center that you guys are, you know, saying they're probably trying to shore up. But there's certainly a neat moral authority that kind of comes with that.
Oh, and I absolutely agree. And that would be, at this point, like the best possible outcome, I think, you know, is, you know, sincere statements of, you know, like, wow, this was not the right thing. I don't think, and as Brad has indicated, I don't really think that's likely to happen, because I feel like the church is trying to narrow its base. And so we have this, we talk a lot in progressive Mormonism about big tent Mormonism, you know, and I think I've just heard this over and over again from people like Joanna Brooks and John Dillon, the idea of big tent Mormonism. And I, for one, had definitely bought into the idea of big tent Mormonism, but I feel like this is, in many ways, a rejection of the idea of big tent Mormonism, among other things. And I feel like the church is almost intentionally, as I said before, trying to shift its base right. And it's just, I think, going to be more successful at that than it had anticipated.
So, I mean, the term retrenchment comes up, which is, you know, your trenches are out here, we're pulling them back, and it's an actual shrinking of the church and, you know, what you're trying to defend.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be an over, like, and that there's going to be fallout. I don't think that they are going to view this as, even more successful than they anticipated. Okay, I think they're going to view it as backfiring.
Okay. Yeah, there is a we could do some predictions here. Rob, anything, and Nancy, I don't know if you had anything, you were kind of reacting to what Brad and I were talking about there, but any graceful way out that you can really see or anticipate?
I don't anticipate a backing down from this position. Okay. Not with the number of people I see defending it. And I know that there are a very large number of people who aren't. But I also see a lot of people, including the conversation into gospel doctrine that I witnessed on Sunday, which I do have I live in a very conservative ward. That people were largely in agreement that the church had done the right thing. I don't see a backing down from this position, although I would love it. You know, I would love that Brad's scenario to play out. I just don't think it'll happen.
Yeah. So prediction wise, you don't think it will. And
no,
Good. Rob,
I'm in the same boat. I think the idealist in Brad, would be nice. And I think you said, Brad, you admitted you don't think that's the reality.
I think we're just going to have this play out.
No, I don't think
it's
clear at all. Yeah.
We'll have this play out and it'll be, you know, we're in a new situation than where we were last Wednesday as far as those of us who...
The ground has shifted. Yeah. There's no
question. It has.
Yeah, and you specifically named Uchtdorf as a potential ally with Oaks on this. And maybe I'd even give you a little bit on that, but just the change in his language in the last conference makes me just even further back away from that. Even as a, is there a nice retraction? Is there a nice loving pull out of this? I don't see that.
No.
Okay.
I don't.
All right. Hey, well, one of the things about Mormon Matters in general is I bring on people who, you know, have brilliance, like you guys just showed. You're articulate, all that stuff. But for the most part, most of my guests have kind of hung in there in Mormonism. Have any of you had to rethink your commitment to stay engaged in an active way and tell that story, if so? But if not, you know, what's gone through your heart these last 5 or 6 days? What are you drawing the most strength from in terms of like, okay, this sucks. It's going to be a longer battle, or, you know, I'm going to be in a different climate now with so many people leaving who, you know, I was most comfortable surrounding myself with. Where are you finding strength? I'll start with Brad and we'll just kind of go through our normal 1, 2, 3 order, if you will.
You know, the strength I need isn't the strength not to resign. I mean, I feel like I'm too deeply a Mormon. My criticisms of Mormonism have always come from a place of caring deeply about Mormonism, feeling like Mormonism needs to better live up to the potential of what it can be.
Right.
So even though there are times when I've been very sharply critical of the church, including and especially the last 5 days, it's always been from a perspective of deeply identifying as Mormon. This has shaken my commitment or my resolve, not necessarily to remain a church member, but to be as actively involved, to participate as actively, to try as hard to instill commitment to Mormonism in my children. It's kind of funny for me because 5 days before the announcement, I baptized my daughter, and I renewed my recommend to do the baptism. And it was, you know, I'd kind of done some soul searching even just in that process. And I'm not sure that if it had come a week earlier, I would have. I mean, I'm not sure that I wouldn't have either, but I'm not sure that I would have. I wonder. So, you know, I got a new calling last week and they were going to sustain me on Sunday. And I asked the bishop to hold off on sustaining me till he and I could chat. You know, I'm considering scaling back my participation to some degree, thinking of it as more of a sabbatical than an exit. But certainly not contemplating writing a resignation letter. But so that's sort of where I'm at in terms of just like the raw hurts. And then when you're asking the question about what gives me strength, the answer would in part go back to the, you know, the what I wrote that Carol Lynn quoted, And it's just watching so many of my close Mormon LGBT friends, even the ones who are not in the church anymore, being reaching out in such caring ways to me, even the ones who probably deep down wish I would resign, still being nothing but supportive and caring, but also watching, you know, the courage of other friends, watching Kendall Wilcox, watching Christian Harrison say this is, and I know it's causing them a deeper kind of pain than it can cause me, and still watching them reaffirm some degree of commitment and patience and willingness to suffer. And, you know, that makes it, I don't know if it makes it easier, but somehow it gives me a degree of strength or a degree of comfort that I won't say it makes it easier for me to stay, but it makes it harder for me to consider leaving. And then just watching in general Mormons who are struggling with this mourn with each other is kind of beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it, in some ways it's just the messiness of the fallout bringing out some of the best in so many of us that makes me, again, that doesn't necessarily make it easier to stay, but somehow makes it harder to leave.
Thank you, Brad. It's beautiful. Nancy, would you share?
Yeah. So I was initially in a state of shock. I think through Thursday night, Geraldine Hasselpool, who's a friend of mine and very prominent Mormon feminist and a graphic designer, made a graphic with a lot of suicide prevention hotline. Yes. And I teach at a university, and I know of a lot of students who are LGBT, and I live in a very Mormon community, which is probably in many ways more conservative than Northern Utah. And so I spent Friday printing out and distributing those posters around campus. And I don't say this to celebrate my activities here, but in a desperate attempt to prevent disastrous action. And then on Monday morning, I ran into a friend of mine in my building who is an advisor, and already over the weekend, there had been a necessity for people to call those numbers. And so that's been my reality for the last few days. And for me, church was something that was a disaster on Sunday. And you have to understand that, like, I'm 35. For 35 years, I've been committed. And I have a temple recommend, and I have a calling, and I'm active in my ward that I feel very rejected by. And I was able to sit next to Kate Kelly and watch her be excommunicated and still reaffirm my commitment to the church and have hope that things would change. And at this point in time, I'm not sure. I don't think I have that same hope. I think that hope is broken. And I have to say also that I'm a bisexual woman, and I've been married to my husband for 11 years, and I feel profoundly rejected by the church that I have served and loved all my life. And I have always believed in the concept of Big Tent Mormonism, but now I can see that the church does not believe in it. And so I really wonder what my place in it can be moving forward, and that's all I'm going to say.
Thank you. That was beautiful and raw and tough, but thank you.
I appreciate that, Nancy.
Yes.
Rob, would you?
That's hard to follow. Yeah, thank you, Nancy. We love you. Hopefully you get that love from us and here. And
absolutely.
So I'm in a little different place than both Brad and Nancy. I'm actually on my sabbatical. And I intentionally use Jana Reese's language there because I claim Mormon identity as a sociologist, capital S. It's hard for me to reject the influence of that on my life, what that means, how it causes me to frame the world. Everything is in some sense colored by the lenses of Mormonism that has been so central and foundational to my life. You know, I was active all my life. It was certainly the core identity, active missionary, loved my mission. So in terms of where I'm at personally, my journey has transitioned maybe a little more darkness prior to this. So when I heard about the new policy, I was probably watching The Wire or something, because I tend to need to watch that every 6 months. But anyway, I was watching some show, and my wife was reading it and reading it in tears, really, expressing to me what was happening. And she's in a place where she's trying to figure out how our family works, how a sabbatical works. So I really appreciate the way you framed the question to all three of us, Dan, that trying to find a place of strength, a place to share community, even in a time when there is a lot of pain. And I really appreciate you, Dan. You've been a voice in my head since, 2008? So it's an honor to be here and to maybe express some things that I think people can cling to. And I would say that whether or not you are worried about the tent now being restaked to, excuse me, to consider you outside, many of us still love you and honor you and hope the best for you. So the community may change. They may claim that the boundary means something. And maybe it does. Maybe for them, if I'm going to be tolerant to the extreme, maybe I need to respect some of the desires that they have to claim their identity in a way that's meaningful and purposeful for them. But I also ask the same for them. So I don't have a good, clean answer to what that means for a person who felt like the tent was big enough to include them. It's very painful and cold to find yourself on the outside of that tent. And sometimes the sabbatical maybe is the answer. You need some perspective. Give yourself space, love, and time to maybe step back if that's necessary. And know that there are people here. And everything I have done with my podcast was not to step on other people's toes who are doing this. Who are trying to reach out. It's to extend those arms further and let folks know that maybe are in dark, cold places that we are here. And that'll be enough, I think.
Thank you. You all three are so amazing. I have appreciated that as well as everything that came before. You know, for me, I'll just quickly do a quick out. It seems about 15 years ago, I just finally completely separated my reasons for being Mormon from anything that had to do with the institution. It was about the time that I took over at Sunstone, and at first when I'm, going into that job, I'm thinking, oh, everything I publish, I'll imagine what the church, just a few blocks away from the Sunstone office would be thinking. And and it turned out to be completely the opposite, because so immediately the overwhelming aspect of what it meant to be the Sunstone editor in a pre-Facebook time, a pre-blogs and pre-online communities time, was simply to nurture a community and to nurture the body of Christ that was surrounding Mormonism and to be a pastoral voice and things like that. And so somehow or other, I'm devastated, like everyone else, that, this church that I thought I was in is now smaller. It's a medium-sized tent, and that's what they want, or whatever it would be. But the commitment that I have to who we are as good people, spiritual giants in, fleshy tabernacles, it just this doesn't touch it. But again, without spiritual practice, without discipline, without service, without, you know, all the things that come with a darn organization and some place to go on Sunday and callings that obligate us to serve each other. You know, it's just like, that is such an important thing for me too. And I don't know, just my weird, big, fat body that smiles, and I'm not too threatening to anybody. Even the people who disagree with me and are afraid of me have a word like me. And so somehow or other I've managed that, and I imagine I'll keep managing it fine. I understand that that's somewhere else, but if just I can just make that appeal, find your own reasons for LDS, being LDS. Find your own, you know, for me it's a real sense of calling. I've had lots of, you know, green lights and various things that came along at the right time that said this was where I'm to be to work out my, you know, life and fear and trembling. I'm not a worrier about salvation type stuff, but this is my community, and I'm sticking with you all. This is body of Christ work. This isn't organizational stuff, and I just love that happened for me, and I pray that something similar for those that feel like they do have a desire to stay. I hope that something can grow in you. It's just your own reasons, and it has nothing to do with leadership, and has everything to do with your neighbors and those that you have met online and these communities that we've built. So I'll close with that as my place of strength, and you know, taking the body blow and still staggering, but moving forward. Hey, you guys, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you, Dan.
Really appreciate it.
It has been a wonderful conversation, and I love the way we closed with this. So bless you all.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.